You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Dreeslein. We'll be with you for the next hour. We'll have Tony Peterson with us. We'll maybe talk some late-season shed hunting with him. Also look ahead to turkey hunting. Corey Raker will also be with us. He's a hardcore wood duck box enthusiast from southern Minnesota. We will talk to him a little bit about that. So some good guests. Please stick around for the whole show. Tim Lesmeister here to help me kick things off. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. And I tell you, I didn't get it in the print version this week, but we will have it in this coming week's edition. The Bassmaster Classic wrapped up, and a young man from Tennessee won that, huh?
Dylan Nutt won that from Tennessee, yes. And I think he was very fortunate that this year's Bassmaster Classic was actually held in Tennessee, out of Knoxville, Tennessee, on the Tennessee River. And he spent a month fishing this river system every day until they turned it off limits. And then when he went back and was able to practice fish on this resource right before the tournament, he found that most of the places that he had discovered when he was practice fishing panned out, and he literally walked away with this tournament. He blew everybody out of the water.
So this was in central Tennessee, so he's a Tennessee guy himself, so kind of home waters. We seem to be on a bit of a theme. Last year, a 22-year-old guy won it. He's 23 now, Easton Fothergill from Minnesota. This year, another young man winning it, Dylan Nutt. You follow this closer than I do, but on social media, some people ranting about these guys using forward-facing sonar.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure these are guys that just don't believe in new technology being able to give somebody all this, what they consider excess advantage. You know, it's one of the things that a lot of people find to be a little disappointing in when they watch competitive fishing or, you know, even some of this angling entertainment, is that most of these people aren't fishing that much anymore. They spend a lot of time watching their screens, and they only target fish. And that's what Nutt did, and almost all of the top guys that were in that higher echelon of anglers in this Bassmaster Classic. These were young guys. These were guys that know how to use this technology. And they're all fishing the same lures, jig heads with plastic baits on them. And they were all using their forward-facing sonar to target individual fish. And that's what these young guys are capable of doing. They're capable of understanding how this works and making it work. And there are a lot of people on social media that are saying that's just not fair. But, you know, all of them are using the technology. So I guess if everybody gets to use it, what's not fair about it?
Yeah, again, we've talked about it a lot. The viewership, I think, is down watching competitive bass fishing because no one wants to just watch people staring at their screens, right? They want to watch people casting and interacting with their fellow angler in the boat and strategizing. It's pretty much turned into is guys just using their trolling motor to buzz around and look for individual fish. The time to have the debate about this is before the event. If more experienced anglers, older anglers, or if you know, the folks promoting us think it's not as good of an event with forward-facing sonar, they need to ban it before the event occurs. But if they don't do that, more power to young Dylan and young Easton and everybody else that's using this, the young guys that understand this technology probably better than anyone, for going out and owning it. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
What I've noticed here is that a lot of these anglers that come from the northern tier of the country that go down south that used to have a lot of difficulty fishing on these reservoirs where there was basically no cover and very little what you call true structure, true drop-offs and cuts and banks and such. They can find the fish sure. much easier now using the forward-facing sonar. And all of a sudden, this puzzle that used to, you know, basically drive them crazy has now been solved because of forward-facing sonars. And the guys from up north are doing just as good as the guys down south in these reservoirs.
Okay. I mean, a local boy did win the tournament, Tim. You know, a Tennessee boy who probably has some good knowledge of those waters. I had a month to burn, like you say.
I think that's why he won it is because he didn't do like a lot of guys did. They went clear down to Lake Teleco. You know, he stayed up there in Fort Loudoun, a little closer to the Knoxville area. And I think that paid off for him. But look at a Canadian won the tournament 1 year.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, Fothergill wins it 1 year. The guys from up north are doing well. If you look at the standings in this latest Bassmaster Classic, surprisingly, a lot of guys were up in high standings in this tournament that normally wouldn't have done well at all 20 years ago when the guys from up north were just totally baffled by these southern reservoirs.
You know, I don't follow the tournament scene that close, but I know one of the series was requiring anglers to not use forward-facing sonar for like half of the events, which I think is a good idea. You know, it forces anglers to show that they can win both ways, with and without forward-facing sonar. That probably is going to impact like Angler of the Year more than an individual event like the Classic. But if folks decide they don't like this, they don't want to see it in the tournament, they got to speak out. But my guess is the cat's out of the bag, Tim. I don't think there's any way to ban this from the Classic going forward, is there?
I don't think it's going to get banned from tournaments before long. It'll be everywhere. It's just one of those, you know, things that comes along that everybody starts to use, and it improves their fishing, and eventually it just becomes part of the program. Look at, you know, sonars went from, you know, these archaic flashers to paper to totally different scene every time one of these new technologies comes along, but eventually it just kind of works itself into the program and it just becomes normal.
You know, this is where you and I disagree. I do think forward-facing sonar is a next level. It's a game changer above and beyond those other things that you mentioned. I think a lot of guides feel the same way. Everybody's going to own it, and everything's going to have to adjust and reach a new equilibrium. I'm with you there, but I think that new equilibrium is going to be lower limits, and we're already seeing that with some species of fish. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Driesein and Tim Lesmeister are kicking off this week's broadcast. Speaking of limits, I had it in my column, Tim, the DNR's public review period for lowering the walleye limit from 6 to 4 wrapped up here on March 5th. They did get enough requests for a hearing before an administrative law judge. I've never been to one of those before. It's not something I think we see very often in fish and wildlife management, but I might try to sit in on that one. That could be interesting.
I think the last time they did that, maybe when they changed the perch limits.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a quarter century ago. That was like, remember, that was on Winnie where they got rolling with that.
Oh, yeah. And so it doesn't happen very often, obviously. But I do believe that the majority of people that they polled said that they wouldn't be bothered by going from a 6 to a 4 fish limit.
We'll see what happens with this. I mean, it's not locked in. I don't know how that hearing could go. I suppose if 2,000 people show up protesting it and trying to get in the hearing, you know, who knows how that could proceed. But the legislature could get involved, too. But the DNR's intent is still to move forward with this 4-fish walleye bag limit. One other walleye note, Tim, Red Lake, you know, and here's an example where the DNR is trying to lower the limit statewide, and yet they're increasing the limit, I think, at least from the winter rig on Upper Red. It's going to be 5 for the open water season, 1 over 17. Sounds like they got a lot of kind of small walleyes up there, and they're encouraged people, anglers, to go up there and take some.
And that's going to make people are going to go there. They're going to fish for those walleyes. I mean, if you can catch 5-16-inch walleyes, that's a good meal. And that's just fun when you get into the kind of fishing that you're going to get into there on Red, because your size structure on that lake is so wide that you're going to be able to catch a limit of walleyes to take home and fillet. Not to mention in between those small fish that you're catching, you're going to catch some 22-inchers, some 24 inchers and maybe even an occasional 28 incher. And there'll be about a half a dozen lucky anglers that'll get one or two over 30. So that's the beautiful thing about Red Lake right now, is that you got a lot of walleyes there, and the limits are, that's a great limit.
Tim, my South Dakota columnist out there, Josh Hare, wrote a piece about South Dakota. Looks like they're getting rid of their bounty program, sort of. Tim, my dad in the middle 1960s was a grad student at South Dakota State in Brookings, and he did his thesis, his master's thesis, on looking at the red fox and their impacts on pheasants. The standard line out there was that the predators like red fox were wiping out all the pheasants. And Dad was one of the folks that was saying, you know, do you think it could have anything to do with the fact that we just took 2 million acres of soil bank out and put it under the plow? Do you think that could have maybe affected the pheasant populations? And so he was literally analyzing the stomach contents of of red fox. We joke about that with him to this day. People were talking, we need bounties on red fox. And you know, we've seen this play out, right, where we do the bounty thing and it costs a bunch of money and it doesn't work. And then someone says, oh, hey, let's invent the Conservation Reserve Program and put 36 million acres in grass. And, ooh, look at the great pheasant hunting across the region. And then it all goes back under the plow. Not all of it, but a lot of it, especially the prime acres. Pheasant populations plunge, you know, out in South Dakota, wink, wink, they don't even give you a forecast anymore, right? They just say, it's always great in South Dakota, come on out. And, you know, then on the sly, they acknowledge the fact that pheasant numbers are plunging, but golly, we wouldn't want to put more grass on the ground because then our big ag donors won't like us anymore. So you know what we'll do? We'll implement a bounty. We'll kill the predators. So they did this 5 years ago. And now even a lot of the Republican legislators out there are saying, you know, this is a big, expensive boondoggle. Why are we doing this? All it does is cost a bunch of money. And so they're eliminating it. Although, again, wink, wink, we're still going to have a bounty on coyotes because everybody hates coyotes all the time. And I guess they're going to do something for the youth. You'll still have a bounty for youth. I've talked a lot. Tim, why don't you chime in?
I'm just happy that they are continuing the bounty for youth. No, I mean, these kids got to figure out a way to pick up a few extra bucks once in a while. But they were paying out really good money.
Yeah.
You know, fur prices, you can't get squat for fur price.
For skunks and raccoons. And
oh, I know. It was amazing. What were they, 10 yeah. bucks? I think per animal. I mean, that's good money. Yeah. Think about that. I'm telling you, the kids got a way to pick up some extra money without having to actually work that hard. Just set some traps and.
You know, I actually don't have a huge problem with it for youth, because we need to do almost anything we can to encourage youth to get outdoors and sample some of these sports. So, I mean, if we're going to pay a kid 50 or 100 bucks to go out and trap some skunks or whatever, and it helps build the next generation of outdoors people, or at least contributes to it. I think we're all a little naive if we think that's going to help us turn the corner, but it won't hurt. I can accept that expense of taxpayer dollars, but grandiose, you know, statewide bounties. Anyone who knows anything about wildlife management tells you they never work. New predators move in. You boost what's called the fecundity rate of these animals. You know, you trap them out, and the ones that are left start. They'll breed twice a year and they'll have twice as many pups or whatever it is they generate. And you end up with as many or more predators in the long run. And you spend a bunch of money when you should have taken those dollars and invested it in grassland, in habitat, in easements, in fee title acquisition. That's what's going to get you more pheasants and other game species on the ground. All right. Well, Tim, we went long there, but thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. We'll catch up to you soon.
Yeah, that was our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Stick around. We'll talk to Tony Peterson when we return. This is Outdoor News Radio.
For those walking the turkey woods this spring, carry a Bold Retay Gobbler shotgun. Top options include the Gordian Turkey Gun with its no-rattle inertia plus rotating bolt and factory lengthened forcing cone, which delivers 20% more pellets. Or the Gamelander Turkey Single Shot, available in 410 and 20 gauge in black and mossy oak bottomland with its airy recoil reduction pad. Find a dealer locator at RetayUSA.com. That's RetayUSA.com. Be the Retay difference.
Spring coho and steelhead are on, and Ken's is leading the charge on Lake Michigan. Fish with Wisconsin's number one Lake Michigan charter service, running out of three prime ports. Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma, Wisconsin. Kick off the season with fast-paced, rod-bending coho and steelhead action out of Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, where limit catches are the expectation, not the exception. Spots fill fast. Call 800-446-8605 or book online at www.kinscatch.com. That's Ken Sports Fishing. Your spring bite starts here.
Attention duck hunters. Are you tired of empty skies? Let's talk solutions at the Minnesota Duck Summit, March 27th and 28th in Nicolet. Join hunters, conservation leaders, and agency experts for sessions on how to take action to improve duck hunting in the region. The summit runs Friday afternoon, March 27th through Saturday morning, and includes a dinner Friday night. Register at the Fergus Falls Fish and Game website. That's fffgcmn.org. fffgcmn.org.
Unleash the power of the Onyx Hunt app this turkey season and see how it'll become one of the best tools in your turkey vest. Use color-coded public and private land ownership information, tree species, and crop layers to scout from the comfort of your home. Then hit the field using compass mode, waypoints, and multiple base maps to help pin down more gobblers this spring. Use promo code ODN20 to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again, then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Hey folks, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Dreisline. Tony Peterson going to join us here in just a moment. If you like what we talk about here, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191 if you would like to subscribe to our print or digital versions. Tony, getting geared up for turkey season, but I thought we'd hit a bunch of topics with him here. Tony, you get through winter. How you doing, man?
Got through winter, buddy. Getting ready to catch some fish and scout a few birds.
Too late for shed hunting, or did that snow last weekend maybe reinvigorate the shed hunting season for this weekend?
You know, I wouldn't say that it's too late. I actually put out a couple cameras for turkeys, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago, and I'm still getting pictures of bucks that are carrying both sides. And so I really like late March for turkeys. I don't like it when we get 15 inches of snow randomly, but there's still definitely time to get out there and find a few.
You wrote a piece about using your dog to find sheds, and it's I believe you said something along the lines that's not something dogs do naturally. Can you kind of recap some of your thoughts on if you want to try to train your hunting dog to search for sheds in the spring, what are some steps?
Some dogs will just go pick up antlers, right? Like just like if you find a coyote den out there, sometimes you'll find antlers around it. You know, you see that out west when you're chasing mule deer, you'll find that. But generally, if you have a bird dog, which is kind of what we're talking about with shed dogs, you know, their focus is something with feathers on it, right? Feathers or fur. And so it's not quite as natural of a thing for them to go pick up a bone, but you can definitely train them to do it. But you have to think about the scent component a little bit, and then you have to think about really, really training their eyes to look for them.
You got to back up for me there a little bit. You said coyote dens sometimes will have sheds laying around. What, coyotes will just randomly pick up sheds? I didn't know that.
I didn't either until I found a couple out west when I was hunting mule deer, and I'm like, man, they look like they've been chewed off by dogs. I started paying attention a little bit more, and you know, out west is sort of a different thing, right? Like they'll see a mule deer shed laying there and pick it up. But I saw a social media post the other day of somebody who found a coyote den and there was a shed laying right by it, and it's like, you know, they're curious, they like chewing on them. It's kind of a novelty thing. I wouldn't recommend like catering your shed hunting strategy to just checking coyote dens, but they will pick them up and they'll go chew them and carry them around.
I'll be darn. Interesting. Yeah, they're inquisitive creatures, so I guess that makes sense. Well, that's one of the last topics of winter is shed hunting. We can maybe kind of transition here to thinking about turkeys a little bit. A policy item, Tony, I don't know if you saw it yet this week. We had a story about some debate within DNR, some dialogue about whether we should consider allowing hunters to take two wild turkeys during the spring season in some areas of the state. It wouldn't necessarily be a statewide issue. I see it got posted on our social media page and a lot of comments. You know, by the next morning, we had over 50 comments on Facebook. My favorite comment, Tony, someone saying, can someone tell me what the article said? I can't get behind the paywall. I'm like, well, let's talk about the topic a little bit, Tony. What do you make of that? I'm a little cautious given what's going on with turkey populations in other parts of the country, but we do have a lot of turkeys here. I think we've had back-to-back record years.
I could get behind it. I mean, just this week, Wisconsin started selling their, leftover tags, mm-hmm. and you see how many tags they get away with selling over there and the turkey pressure. We could get away with it, especially if they structured it where, you could only use the second tag, maybe the last 2 weeks of the season or something like that. But Minnesota is, I know people get super ticked off about this, but Minnesota is slower than a lot of other states on a lot of stuff. And so people will, they'll talk about how, maybe the turkey population couldn't support it. And you could look at every state that touches us just about. And, they've been allowing more than one turkey tag for a long time. And you see this throughout the country. But you did bring up a good point there where, some of these kind of, mainstay states in middle of America where, turkey hunting really took hold and, where our culture kind of came from. A lot of those states are dealing with way lower turkey numbers than, 10, 12 years ago. And they're trying to figure out why. And there's a lot of theories out there, right? Like we've gotten really good at killing dominant toms. We have we have really good decoys. We have a lot of advantages there. I don't know if I believe that one is the source. I mean, there are people who are better that are at arguing that point than me. I feel like it has to be something habitat wise, disease wise or something, because you're seeing it, from Kansas all the way down through the Southeast. And it just feels to me like it couldn't just be a suddenly hunting pressures doing this now. I don't know. I don't see it.
I've talked to a couple biologists down there who seem to think it definitely has something to do with, loss of habitat. The rate of development in a lot of those southern states, I mean, every woodlot is being converted into a subdivision down there now. And we're losing a lot of those woodlots. And its impact in turkey numbers. It's something we've explored in a number of stories in Outdoor News. And I guess I'm just glad it isn't happening here yet, Tony. But
right.
It's worrisome when you see it in other parts of the country. I wonder if it's going to work its way up here.
Well, I'm curious, too. And I always wonder, when you talk about everybody kind of wants to have one thing to point their finger at. Right. And be like, well, it must be. Must be wolves killed all the deer. It must be, no more CRP.
Tony, by the way, someone on Facebook said we need to manage the wolves first before we increase the turkey number. The timber. Right. I can't wake it up.
I know. There's a lot going on out there, right? And so I always think, when you look at upland game bird populations and what they need to pull off successful nesting and have a viable population that isn't going to get knocked into non-existence after one bad winter. I always think about turkeys and I go, if it is a habitat issue, which there's no question there's a habitat component, then you also give a lot of the nest predators and a lot of the predators a better chance to kill more of them. So rarely is it just like one thing where you can be like a virus swept through and killed half the turkeys off. Like that's usually not how it goes. It's usually slow burn of some kind of habitat thing. And that allows the coyotes and the bobcats to do a better job. And pretty soon you see that, see it break bad. And I wonder what's going on with the turkey thing, because I know some states are putting a lot of horsepower behind their research into figuring out why. Because like you said, if you don't have a viable, really good, viable turkey hunting population, things are going to change in a lot of these states. Like that's a big component of why people travel there. And I don't know, it scares me to see it, but we haven't experienced it yet.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Jerisano with Tony Peterson. Just a couple minutes left. You know, they say nature abhors a vacuum. Nature also abhors a surplus. And if there's a species that occupies a niche that's been unoccupied for a while, and all of a sudden that population explodes, other critters are gonna cash in on that. We've got a lot of golden eagles in western Wisconsin and southeastern Minnesota that winter there now that we didn't see 50 years ago. And you know, some biologists believe one reason is because there's this interesting new prey base called the wild turkey.
Yep.
That's allowed those golden eagles to start inhabiting that area. Yeah, you mentioned bobcats. There's a lot more of those on the landscape now, more coyotes. Back to the actual hunting impact. How many guys do you think would actually kill two turkeys? You know, we can talk about, we can allow two turkeys. Not everyone's going to do that. Pretty small subset of guys that's going to go out there and kill two birds a year.
Other than my really good buddies, I don't know. I got a couple of buddies who would do it for sure. But yeah, I mean, it would be almost negligible, I would guess, especially if they divided it by season. You know, it'd be kind of like with the deer thing. You know, when we went from, it wasn't that long ago in our history where most of the state you got a tag, right? An either sex tag, and that was about it. And then maybe you could get one management tag. And for a while it was like intensive harvest in a lot of places. And they still saw that most of the hunters killed one deer at most, right? And so I think turkeys would be the same way. I mean, the thing that you have to be careful with, and you see a lot of states do this with turkeys, is there's some kind of stipulation on not killing two in the same day. And that saves a lot of them, right? Because you think about it, if you're sitting there with two tags and a bunch of birds come in, or a flock of jakes or whatever, then it's pretty easy to kill two.
Yeah.
But if it's like, well, you can hunt, you know, this week, and then you got to wait, you know, kill bird, whatever, then you got to wait till the end of the season or something. That would be a good way to put a governor on this thing and see where it ended up. But I don't think a lot of people would kill two.
Tony, before we go, crossbows. It looks like the sunset is going to get removed once and for all, probably this session. Crossbows during the archery season. But you and I have talked about this. That doesn't bother you, right?
I mean, it just is what it is. You know, my daughters hunt with them, and I love that component of it. You can just see the trend, right? And it's not just our state. Once they get legalized, and they'll be in every state eventually, I think, and they're not going away. It's a easier, more convenient weapon, and they're crazy popular. A lot of people were going to use them, and they are.
Well, that's probably the last word on it. We'll see if I fully expect it to pass the session, but I guess it's probably time to move on from the great crossbow debate. We're out of time for this week, Tony. Next week, you'll join us, and we'll talk some hardcore turkey tactics. How's that sound?
Sounds good, man.
All right. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
That's our friend Tony Peterson. Appreciate him being on the broadcast. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
Attention duck hunters, are you tired of empty skies? Let's talk solutions at the Minnesota Duck Summit, March 27th and 28th in Nicolet. Join hunters, conservation leaders, and agency experts for sessions on how to take action to improve duck hunting in the region. The summit runs Friday afternoon, March 27th through Saturday morning, and includes a dinner Friday night. Register at the Fergus Falls Fish and Game website. That's fffgcmn.org. fffgcmn.org.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the Squirrel Woods to Deer Camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
You fish the same waters year after year. But what if your next best fishing story is just a few miles away? Onyx Fish builds on 15 years of experience, giving hunters and adventurers a revolutionary angling tool to help you find new water, new access, and new fish. Find the right lake. Know the species, size, and abundance. Get expert local insight. Navigate to the right ramp fast. Then go fish in new lakes like they're your home waters. Don't chase reports. Make your own with Onyx Fish.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Did you know 22 Americans die each day waiting for organ transplants, most of them for kidneys? The good news is that MatchingDonors.com is helping to change that. MatchingDonors.com is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that links organ donors with people in desperate need of kidneys and other transplants. And now you don't need to donate a kidney to save a life. You can donate your boat, car, or real estate, with 100% of the proceeds going to help save the lives of people needing organ transplants. Visit MatchingDonors.com or call 800-385-0422.
Everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning into the broadcast. I hope you like what we talk about here. If so, check us out online at outdoornews.com or give us a call at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to Outdoor News print or digital versions that way by giving us a call or visiting that website. It's that time of year when we push pretty hard at Outdoor News with our Wood Duck Challenge. We encourage young people or adults alike to build some wood duck boxes out there and get them out in the wetlands and the forests to try to help the birds. I tell you what, just a few weeks ago, I was worried that it would be too late to talk about wood duck boxes, but then winter came roaring back here this past week. So there's still lots of times to get your wood duck boxes out. And there's a gentleman, he's an educator down in southern Minnesota, who is very active with wood duck box building with his students. He's a teacher in Maple River, which is south of Mankato, and I'm really excited to have him on here and talk about the work he's done with wood duck boxes over the years. His name is Corey Raker, and he's a fifth grade teacher. Corey, thanks for carving out some time to chat with me here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to spread the news about what we do, how we do it, and why we do it.
Wood duck boxes have been around a long time. When I was a kid in the early 80s, we built some wood duck boxes. And, you know, there's been some ups and downs with wood duck boxes over the years. Some folks think if you don't put them up properly, they actually can be problematic. I'm guessing that that's all part of your protocol when you're working with your kids to build these wood duck boxes. But let's back up first. Why is wood duck box building so important to you, Corey Raker? Tell us about your background and why you implemented this in your teaching.
It's important to me because when I was a kid, my dad and one of his buddies introduced wood duck nest box building to me, and I got hooked on it. It got in my blood. And as I was growing up, every year I'd ask, can we build a couple wood duck houses? Can we build a few more wood duck houses? Because I loved being outdoors, and there's not a better way to be outdoors and spend quality time with your family than doing wood duck nest boxes.
And so, where was that, Corey? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up down here, south of Mankato, Minnesota Lake, Minnesota.
Okay. This is an important area, an important part of the state to you. You told me off air you've been a teacher since 1999. Was this something you implemented immediately with your students?
Yes, I did. Back in 1999, I was able to get a grant through Blue Earth County Soil and Water. And we built wood duck houses for probably the first 5 years. Every year we would build nest boxes and we would do it in the high school shop. And then, you know, I got married and then kids came along and I was coaching and I kind of went away with the project for my students for a few years. And then I decided I got to get back into this and I have full swing. But what everybody needs to understand, this isn't just me. I'm the one who organizes it. I'm the one who goes out and does all the fundraising. But I could not do this by myself. I have a bunch of buddies that help with the pre-cutting and getting stuff all set for the day. And more importantly, on the day of the build, the only thing the kids need to bring to the shop room on the day of our wood duck nest box project is a parent and a cordless drill. So that's where I need volunteers. Because if you can visualize 50 kids in a shop at one time with an adult, And a lot of them have never built one before. Sure. That's why it's important to expose them to them. My volunteers are there to help them out.
So a lot of the lumber is either donated or purchased using some of the fundraising dollars that you generate?
Absolutely. I'm fortunate that we have a local home building business who also sells lumber, Nordis American Homes out of Minnesota Lake, and they give me a really good deal on the lumber plus donate. So that's what makes it possible. It cuts down on the cost.
And you're doing this at the shop. You said the shop, is this at like the local high school?
Yep, the local high school.
On average, how many wood duck boxes do you folks crack out in a year during this wood duck building day?
This year we did 325. Last year we were over 300. In the last 4 years, we've done 1,000.
That's a lot of wood duck boxes
for
a small community. I'd almost be worried, are there enough wetlands around to put up a box over?
This is the cool thing, Rob, is I tell my students, don't believe everything you read on the internet, right? And that is true when you're researching wood ducks. There's a lot of false information out there. There's information out there that says you can't have a wood duck house too close to another wood duck house or they'll interfere with each other and won't be successful. Well, I've learned through my years out in the field, trial and error, what works and what doesn't work. And one thing that I found through my data is once wood ducks use a nest box in a certain area, you have to add more because they imprint on them and they come back. My daughters, I have a daughter in eighth grade and a daughter in sixth grade. And every year in January, February, they come with me to clean out our nest boxes. This year, we've cleaned out 111 of our nest boxes this year, and we have had an 89.3% success rate on our nest boxes. And then when we're cleaning them out, Rob, what I do is I keep records. So if I'm in an area where if I have 10 nest boxes and they all get used or 9 out of 10 get used, I add a couple more the following year. And in areas where the raccoons, lots of raccoons, they're a predator for both the hen wood duck and the eggs, I use predator guards, which I got made up.
Predator guards are really, really important with wood duck boxes. That's what the Wood Duck Society used to call best practices. And it's something we've incorporated into our wood duck challenge plans available at OutdoorNews.com. Go to OutdoorNews.com and just search wood duck challenge or just Google Outdoor News Wood Duck Challenge and you'll see a set of plans on how to build a wood duck house and how to properly place it with that predator guard. Now, it almost sounds like you don't use predator guards on 100% of your boxes.
I do not use predator guards on 100% of my boxes because of the cost and because of location. There's certain locations where I haven't had issues with coon, and there's other locations where I have. The nest boxes that we use are really deep. I've experimented with all different types of wood duck nest boxes. I use a wood duck nest box that's really deep. I haven't had issues.
Basically, by it being really deep, that means the raccoon can't reach in there and grab the hen. That's what you're talking about. Correct. I believe the Outdoor News Wood Duck Challenge box is a little more shallow. And so I would encourage folks to always use a predator guard if they use that version. You talked about cleaning the houses out. Why do you do that? Why is that so important?
Well, that's pretty cool. Why I clean them out is because you're always, every year, some nests, when you clean them out, you're going to have 100% hatch rate. And then there will also be nests with why it's important to clean them out is because there will be eggs in there that didn't hatch. And that is one of two reasons. Maybe it was just a bad egg. But more commonly, why you get dead eggs in a nest is when that hen starts her incubation period, which lasts about 28 days, she has to, in the morning, go out and get a drink, get something to eat, and in the evening, go get a drink, get something to eat. Lots of times when that hen leaves her nest, another hen wood duck who's in the area needs to find a place to deposit her egg. If she lays her egg in that hen's clutch, okay, when the hen is already sitting, that egg won't hatch. So that's one thing I told my girls. I said, be very careful with the eggs that don't hatch because there's nothing that smells worse.
Yeah, they'd be really, really ripe about this time of year, even if they are frozen. You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline. We are chatting with someone who's really into wood duck boxes. His name is Corey Raker. He's an elementary school teacher, fifth grade, down in Maple River, Minnesota. That's south central Minnesota. And has great success down there with his students building, he said, 350 wood duck boxes this year. Is it too late right now? We're getting into mid to late March. Too late to build wood duck boxes and put them up, or do you think we still have time?
It's never too late to build a wood duck box and put it up. And to get back to the cleaning part, Rob, in my mom and dad's backyard, my mom keeps an eye on the nest boxes back there. And she'll call and say, Corey, I think one hatched out of this box. And this first baby ducklings I see every year are right around the fishing opener, the walleye opener. Once they hatch out of a nest box, and if I know they've hatched, I will go clean out that nest box. And often within a week, there will be another hen that will take over that nest box.
Are you a waterfowler yourself? Do you shoot a few woodies in the fall?
Yes, I am. What I consider myself and my buddies, we're conservationists. So we want to give back more than what we take. And I tell you what, if it wasn't for all our wood duck houses that we have up in our area right now in southern Minnesota, we wouldn't have very many ducks. By far, the majority of the ducks we saw last fall were woodies.
I completely believe that. Why do you think youth embrace wood duck box building so much? It sounds like the kids really love it. What do you chalk that up to?
I tell you what, this is the one thing that it's one of many things that makes me continue to raise money and continue to build wood duck nest boxes with kids. Because I tell you what, Rob, you can't imagine the looks that in those kids' faces of a sense of ownership and how proud they are of their wood duck nest box. Now, this class, they just don't show up and build a house in the shop and leave. It's an hour-long class. I split it in half, and half of the kids will be in a classroom across from the shop. Colin Nienhaus is our middle school science teacher, and he lets me use his classroom because it's a lot closer to the high school shop than mine is. So we split the class in two. The kids go in the classroom for a half hour where, I don't know if you remember the Marty Stauffer videos.
Sure,
Wild America. I have one of those, and I show a little clip of that so the kids can put two and two together. That video in particular is titled Woodies and Hoodies, because we get quite a few hooded mergansers use nest boxes. So the kids get to actually see the wood ducks and the hooded mergansers. But the cool part that really gets their attention is the photography that they had when they, back in those days, there was a camera inside the nest box, which we have now, but back then. So it shows the baby wood ducks hatching from an egg and jumping out of the nest box, and the little fuzzballs following their mom around. So then the kids can put two and two together. They know this is what we're helping. Then they move over to the shop room, and then they build their house. Last year, I had a mom email me and say, Mr. Raker, you got to talk to my daughter because she doesn't want us to put her wood duck house up. This goes to the ownership. She had it in her bedroom and said, no, this is mine.
Like a work of art, huh?
Yeah. So I talked to her and I said, you know, remember that video with the baby wood ducks? She's like, yeah. I said, how many baby wood ducks are going to jump out of your nest box if it's in your bedroom? She looked at me and says, none. And I said, do you want to help the ducks? She said, yes. I said, I'll help you put it up. Okay. So we got it up.
That's an awesome little anecdote. Unfortunately, Corey, I'm out of time, but I guess it goes without saying you'd encourage other folks around Minnesota to get into wood duck box building. You're the Pied Piper of it, man. You definitely have a love for it. That's very clear. The Wood Duck Challenge at OutdoorNews.com, great way to go.
Could I add one more thing?
Yep.
We're Maple River School District, but last year and this year, we've also partnered with the St. Clair School District. And the reason why is St. Clair Legion Post 475, so they're a completely different school district, has given generous donations to our project. If we would include the St. Clair kids, I said, absolutely, I will include any student who wants to learn about conservation and wood ducks. So the kids of the St. Clair School District have had the same opportunity to join us the last 2 years.
Corey, I hope you have a great spring. I hope fishing's good for you. I hope you rear a lot of wood ducks, and that this summer and this fall is good for you for duck hunting.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. That was Corey Raker, fifth grade elementary teacher down in Maple River, Minnesota, south central Minnesota, where this man and his students and a lot of other volunteers and some other school districts are producing a bumper crop of wood duck houses and young wood ducks that jump out of them. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. Attention duck hunters, are you tired of empty skies? Let's talk solutions at the Minnesota Duck Summit, March 27th and 28th in Nicolet. Join hunters, conservation leaders, and agency experts for sessions on how to take action to improve duck hunting in the region. The summit runs Friday afternoon, March 27th through Saturday morning, and includes a dinner Friday night. Register at the Fergus Falls Fish and Game website. That's fffgcmn.org, fffgcmn.org.
Spring coho at Steelhead are on, and Kins is leading the charge on Lake Michigan. Fish with Wisconsin's number one Lake Michigan charter service, running out of three prime ports: Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma, Wisconsin. Kick off the season with fast-paced rod-bending coho and steelhead action out of Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, where limit catches are the expectation, not the exception. Spots fill fast. Call 800-446-8605 or book online at www.kinscatch.com. That's Kin Sports Fishing. Your spring bite starts here.
For those walking the turkey woods this spring, carry a Bold Retay Gobbler shotgun. Top options include the Gordian Turkey Gun with its no-rattle inertia plus rotating bolt and factory lengthened forcing cone, which delivers 20% more pellets. Or the Gamelander Turkey Single Shot, available in 410 and 20 gauge in black and mossy oak bottomland with its airy recoil reduction pad. Find a dealer locator at RetayUSA.com. That's RetayUSA.com. Be the Retay difference.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
Your land is your legacy, but keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land in Michigan, Wisconsin, or Minnesota, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
Like every serious angler in this region, I want to make the most of my time on the water. That's why I read OutdoorNews.com. This all-new digital resource is loaded with valuable tips, lake profiles, up-to-date fishing reports, gear reviews, and breaking news on laws and regulations that affect the sports we love. Plus, OutdoorNews.com will help you catch more and bigger fish. Be prepared and get ahead of the crowd. Join OutdoorNews.com today. Hey, everybody, I've got a few minutes left here before we wrap up for this week, and I've got a special guest who's joining me. I haven't talked to anyone from this organization before. His name is Logan Rydell. He's a project manager with Minnesota Native Landscapes, and he's here now to talk about something that's really going to get rolling in coming weeks. That's work on people's property to improve your property for wildlife, to improve it for water quality, for pollinators, that sort of thing. Logan, thanks for carving out some time to chat with me.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
Tell me a little bit about MNL, Minnesota Native Landscapes. It's been around for a while, and you're really gearing up, I would think, for your busy season.
Yeah, so for over 25 years, MNL has been existing to heal the earth. That's kind of our mantra. That's our go-to statement. And we're full-service ecological restoration. So like you mentioned, pollinators. We also help with wetland restoration, stream banks, and shorelines, whether it's, you know, thousands of acres at a time or just these little backyard pollinator plots. That's what we try to do, is heal the earth.
The operation is based in Otsego. You were telling me you've got projects, of course, in Minnesota as kind of your home base, but across really the upper Great Lakes region. What's a typical project you're getting calls about now? Are you involved in prescribed burning, or are you more on the seeding side?
Yeah, so we have multiple divisions, and kind of MNL being the umbrella, we have those divisions within MNL. So getting rolling on prescribed fires here pretty soon. Some areas are closer than others, than where I'm looking outside to snow. Other places are ready to light a match. We also have the construction side, so our seeding, our prairie plantings, our tree plantings, our wetland restorations. And then on the vegetation management side of things, we also manage existing projects, whether we did it or not. So these projects take some time to establish, but they also require a lot of maintenance in those first couple of years. So we kind of have a turnkey kind of style business, in that if you want something new, we can help you get it installed. And we're ramping up to be doing those here pretty soon.
I tell you what, 10 days ago, I was hearing from land managers that it would be too dry to burn this spring. This recent snowfall probably helped. I got to prescribe burning back on your agenda.
Oh, yeah. Yep. There'll be some dry and hot and windy days like there always is in the springtime. But yeah, this shot of moisture has really helped a lot of other projects as well. But prescribed burning will kick off here pretty soon.
Your website is mnlcorp.com, and you've got a blog there with some great posts. There's one here that says, what makes buckthorn so invasive? The others on fall and winter seeding. How much time do you spend on buckthorn, I got to ask?
All winter long and in the summer. I mean, that is a job security 101, because that stuff is pretty that stuff's pretty potent and pretty prominent in a lot of landscapes. So if you do have buckthorn this time of the year or in the wintertime, we're spending a lot of time doing that stump cutting treatment, right? You can go in and you can forestry mow. And then in the times of the spring and then later fall, you're doing that herbicide foliar application to try to let that herbicide get sucked in throughout the growing season. So yeah, like I said, it's pretty prominent out there.
Pollinators have become a big priority. That's a word that I think, you know, even rank and file citizens from all walks of life use. Kids talk about pollinators, monarch butterflies, that sort of thing. Do you have a lot of, you know, fairly small scale projects out there with folks who say, you know, I want to improve pollinator habitat just in my backyard?
Yeah, we do. We work with individual residential landowners all the time because they have spots in their yard that are hard to grow grass, or maybe they're just sick of mowing a steep hillside or in those kinds of areas. Shaded areas are sometimes hard to grow other things in too. So they're perfect spots to put back into nature. Obviously, the monarch butterfly being kind of the staple, the image that everybody thinks of, but there's a lot of them out there that require all sorts of different habitat types and different flowers, grasses, and forbs throughout the growing season.
We've talked about some small-scale projects. What are some big-scale projects that you're involved in? Do you build ponds? Tell me about some of your big-scale projects.
Yeah, so large-scale wise, we work with government entities like Fish and Wildlife, the DNR, local soil and water conservation districts that are doing water quality and water quantity projects. So building and establishing wetlands, also doing like tile breaking to establish those wetlands. And then the seasonal government programs for putting land into conservation projects. We do a lot of large-scale seedings that way too.
Is a benefit of native landscaping the fact that kind of once you do it, it's pretty well set for a few years because it's native? I mean, these are plants that evolved here. Is that a benefit of native landscaping?
Yeah, it certainly is. Like anything, it takes a little TLC up front, right? Because there's going to be some things like weed competition, because we're essentially leveling the playing field for these native species to be reintroduced. Definitely planting stuff that is regional and things that are historically found there. Definitely adapted to the various soil types that we even deal with here in Minnesota. So the idea is that with a little TLC and the right maintenance and site prep beforehand, it essentially becomes hands off after a couple of years. Yeah.
You're not too busy to take on new projects, raring to go this spring and summer?
Yep. We're taking phone calls and requests all the time for us to get out because everybody's sick and tired of sitting inside all winter long. We're ready to get out and start seeing these sites and start working with landowners to heal the earth.
The best way to reach you folks is through mnlcorp.com.
Yes, that'll get you to kind of our leads team. If you have a project in mind, there's some more info here. If you have questions, you can reach out to us. There's some phone numbers on the bottom of our homepage as well, but that is the easiest way to get a hold of us and really kind of decide if M&L or when M&L can help you, because there's a lot of really cool projects that we have showcased on the website.
Well, thanks for talking about this topic with me a little bit here today, Logan. You're going to be busy. Catch your breath now, because it's going to be a busy season, I'm sure, just in a matter of days or at the very least weeks. MNLCorp.com. Thanks a lot, and have a good spring and summer.
Thank you. You bet.
That was Logan Rydell from Minnesota Native Landscapes, MNLCorp.com. With that, we're out of time. Everybody have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Dreeslein, signing off for Outdoor News Radio.
Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story and the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.